ॐ भद्रं हरने विश्रिनुयामदेवाः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षतिर्यजत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टुवागुंसस्तनूभिः यशेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तारक्षो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः. In the verse 5, Yasmin Jiao. Yasmin Jiao Prithivi Chantariksham. Yasmin Jiao Prithivi Chantariksham. Otam Manasah Pranashta Sarvaihi. Otam Manasah Pranashta Sarvaihi. Tameva ekam janata atmanam. Tameva ekam janata atmanam. Anyabacho vimuchita. Amritasyaisha setuhu. Yasmin dhyauhu. Dhyauhu. Yasmin dhyauhu. Prithivi cha antariksham otam manaha saha pranaihi cha sarvaihi tam eva ekam janata atmanam anyaha vachaha vimuchita amritasya Eshaha Setuhu. The previous two verses were on the on how to meditate on Om, using Om as the bow, and then your mind sharpened through upasana, to using that bow of Om for the mind to completely merge in into yourself. The Atma is Brahman. So they spent two verses on that. Now this verse is talking about the nature of Brahman, and then the next verse will get back to this a meditation on Om. So this verse is a beautiful verse. It's a Mahavakya. It says, Yasmin, in whom, meaning Brahman, in whom, Jyauhu, the heavens, Prithivi, the earth, Antariksham, and everything in between. So you have the heaven and earth and all the space in between. So in whom the heaven, the earth, all the space in between, Antariksham, that which is between the two, Otam, is woven. Then Manaha Saha Pranaihi Sarvaihi, also the mind together with all of the pranas, all of the vital force. So the one in whom the heavens and the earth and everything in between and the mind and all of the organs and all of the pranas, means all of the organs of action, the sense organs, the vital force, the whole sukshma sharira, everything that makes an individual, right? Really all of the subtle components of the sukshma sharira. So your mind and prana and your organs of action and sense organs and all of that. All of it is woven in whom. Woven means the warp and woof, in whom, the one who is the warp and woof, right? All the one for whom all is the warp and woof of all of this. Tameva ekam janata. May you know that one alone. Tam is that one, that Brahman alone. Tameva ekam. May you know that one, that alone, that one alone, or that one Brahman, which is one, ekam, tameva, ekam, janata. May you know that one to be atman, to be yourself. That one in whom this entire creation and everything in it is woven, may you know that one to be yourself. Then he says, Anya vachaha, anyaha vachaha vimuchata. Give up everything else you've heard. All the other statements that you've heard, vimuchata, give that up. Because here, if you remember, we have to remember the context, right? So the other statements are the first part of the Vedas, all of the karmakanda, for the all of the karmas that we do for artha, our protection, for kama, for enjoyment, dharma, in order to get other worlds, all of the karmas that we do in order to gain results, to reap the fruits of our actions, all of those karmas, you know, all of those things that you've learned up to this time, all of those words, all of those Shruti statements that make up the first portion of the Vedas, all of them that have cause and effect, or do a karma in order to achieve a result, all of those words, anyaha vachaha, all of those words, vimuchita, may you give all of that up, says. Amritasya esha setuhu. It is this Brahman that is the setu, that is the bridge of immortality. Amrita means immortality, moksha. This is the bridge. It's this that is the bridge. It is this jnana, this knowledge, that is the setuhu, the bridge for amrita, for immortality. Not any of these other things. Because all of these other things are bound in time, right? They are limited karmas that produce limited ends. And a limited karma that produces a limited end, if the karma is limited and takes place in time, the end and the result will be limited and take place in time. And so there is no getting out of that cycle of samsara as long as you're bound within it through means and ends. It's all through means and ends. I do this to achieve this. Then there is no way out. And everything that I achieve will be limited in nature, just like the action I'm doing to achieve that thing. And so there's not going to be any type of permanence or immortality within that sphere. That sphere means what? This sphere, the sphere of this universe that exists, in which everything is subject to change. So within this sphere, there is no amrita, there is no moksha, there's no liberation, there's no getting out of the situation. And so, forget it. It's really, literally, forget it. Anyaha vachaha vimunchata. Vimunchata. Give it up. Give up all of those words, all of those statements, all of those flowery. In the Bhagavad Gita, another text, section of the Gita, it says, give up all of these flowery statements that are making all of these promises. You can go to Swarga, but they then, later you find out, you go to Swarga, but of course you'll come back. You know? And that's the highest you can achieve. That's the highest you can achieve. You can achieve a period of well-being from which you will come back. Just here, we have the same thing here in samsara, just in here, in this plane of existence. You achieve little moments of swarga from which you come back. Probably, we'd never call it swarga because the moments are so short. So short-lived. But all of them are from which you come back. So you have to understand that for a mumukshu, that the reason that you're a mumukshu, in fact, is in Shankara's commentary, is because you have understood that, right? That any activity within samsara has limited ends, and anything about yourself, your body, your mind, your sense organs, the whole jiva upadi, is limited by nature and subject to change and subject to death. Every single part of it, in fact, every single part that you have taken yourself, that you have taken to be you, is subject to change and subject to death. And so anything that you may do to prolong the inevitable is just that. It's prolonging the inevitable. So anything that you do to prolong your well-being is just that. You're prolonging your well-being. If you get to have a elongated period of well-being, that's just a big chunk of punya that you've just exhausted. When it comes to an end, if you have some prolonged unhappiness, that's a big chunk of papa that you've just exhausted. In fact, in India, sometimes they'll think when they've gone through some sorrow, some very hard situation or very, very negative situation, and they've come out the other end of it, they feel relieved because that little piece of papa is over. And after all, if you see that this lifetime, from a Hindu perspective, this lifetime, having this human birth, is about 50-50 in terms of the types of experiences that you're going to have to, the type of situations you're going to have to experience. You know? Half of those situations are designed to allow an inner peace or inner relaxation where you can feel happy, all is well with me, because the situation isn't rubbing you. And then 50% of them are designed to rub. Yeah. They're designed to rub. And they're designed to not rub. 50, not rub, 50, rub. Whether you are rubbed is another thing, right? But they're designed, you know, they're designed to rub you. So if they're designed to rub you, the only way they're not going to rub you is if, because your knowledge or what you are now looking for in requiring in terms of your peace of mind is not as attached to these objects in the world, right? If something is not going the way that I want, you know, but it does, but I don't care, then I'm not going to suffer, even though it's not going the way that I would choose. If that's all right with me, because my ananda is not dependent on it going the way that I want, then I can be okay. I'll still have my ananda. But that isn't the condition of a samsari. A samsari is totally dependent upon the conditions going the way that I want in order for me to be happy. Because the samsari is the one who has superimposed onto the creation the source of fullness. And I don't superimpose it onto all of the creation. I superimpose it onto certain things in the creation. Right? And those things need to behave in a certain way in order for me to be happy. It means in order for my mind to relax. You're all doing as I like. And so my mind is all right for the moment. Right? But somebody acts up, and all of a sudden, you know, the mind doesn't feel all right anymore, and sorrow is born. And so this samsara, which is really all the first portion of the Vedas is teaching you to do, is how to handle this samsara. What is the best way to handle samsara so that you can survive not having self-knowledge? What is the best way to survive? It teaches you all about dharma, teaches you about proper behavior. It teaches you all of kind of the tricks of the trade for keeping a relative shanti in this world of means, of limited means and ends. That's the first part of the Vedas. How to keep your mind in a state of relative peace, relative equipoise. Yeah. But that requires continual maintenance. It is continual maintenance because, from your standpoint, you still are a limited individual within this creation trying to gain your happiness. That's what it is. You're trying to gain your happiness either through dharmic behavior or through the acquiring of pleasures and avoiding of painful situations. Mm. You know? You're still trying to gain your happiness. And that means then I'm trying to acquire, gain situations that will give me happiness. Right? And I'm trying to acquire and gain states of mind also through dharma that will give me a modicum of happiness and a modicum of peace. But this is still, it's all still in the world of means and ends, and you're still one among many. The question was, in the begin the Upanishad, what is it knowing which? Is there something knowing which everything is known? Is there something here that is the truth of this whole thing? That was the question. And now this question, and that question is going to run through the whole Upanishad. So now look at how he's answering. Check Tasmin nu bhagavo vignate sarvamidam vignatam bhavati. Hey Bhagavan, when this thing is known, when what is known, sarvam idam vignatam bhavati. Everything is as well known. This is what Shaunaka asks to Angirasa. So now, the answer is yourself. And here it says, Janata Atmanam. May you know yourself to be that. May you know yourself to be that, knowing which everything is as well known. What is that self? That self is Brahman, the one in whom the heavens, the Dhyao, the heavens, the earth, the antariksha, the space, your mind, your sense organs, your prana, the one that is the very being, the very warp and woof of all of this. So Swamiji, I read his bhasha on this, and it's interesting, that Chuck just brought it up today too. It's the same, but he used the same example. When you think of warp and woof, you know, if you think of a cloth being made, but the first thing when they're weaving a cloth, they put all of the strings going one way, and then they weave through, right? They weave through. And so in the Upanishads, in fact, they use the example of a cloth, a woven cloth, on which a seam, through the weaving of the threads, a seam is woven. So a sun is woven, a sky is woven, right? The clouds are woven. And then the mountains are woven with a lake woven. So a beautiful scenery is woven into the cloth. But when you look at it, you see a world. You see a world in the cloth. But when you analyze the cloth, what you realize is there is no sun there, really. There's thread. There's no clouds there. You could say there's cloth. You know, the sun is the cloth. The sky is the cloth. The mountains are the cloth. The lake is the cloth. And what is the cloth? The cloth is really the warp and the woof of the threads. And so really what you do, if you were to pull the threads out, this example he gives, if you were to pull the threads out, the sun goes, and then the clouds go, and then the sky goes, and then the mountains go. Pretty soon you just have a ball of thread. That's all you have. Right? And so here, if we were to look at here, this as a big tapestry made of only one thing, a tapestry made of one thing, what is the warp and woof of this tapestry that we're experiencing here? And here he says, the warp and woof in which all of this is woven, this world that we're experiencing, the warp and woof of this, the very sun, by that he means the very substance, the very being of this, the thing that it is made of, the actual stuff that is here, is Atman, is your being. You are the warp and woof of this whole thing, and that's why you are called Brahman. Because Brahman, if I say you, yourself is Brahman, what that literally means is that the Atma, if I take the Atma, that means the conscious being that I am, the conscious being that I am viewing, defining from the standpoint of the jiva upadhi. There I call myself, this is myself. Right? I'm looking at myself, the conscious being, from the standpoint of this body, mind, sense organs. Here in this, it's the mind and the pranas and the individuality that's in the painting, right? There's an individual in the painting. There's an individual in this warp and woof. There's the whole creation, and in that is an individual. And that individual in the painting or in the tapestry is looking around at the tapestry. Right? They're looking at something in the tapestry. Well, that individual, if we go to the being of that individual, we call that the Atma. That's the self. If we go to the being of the tapestry as a whole, we call that Brahman. So what is the knowledge is that the being of the individual is the being of the whole. Right? And so when we say that you, yourself, is the being of the tapestry, that yourself is the being of the creation, then you become Brahman. You now get the name of Brahman. Right? It's not that you don't be, that's misspoken. It's not that you become Brahman. You recognize that you are Brahman. To recognize that you are Brahman means to recognize that you are the substance of the whole, not just the substance of this body. So let's look at it. If I say right now, if I recognize myself as a conscious being, which is a given, it's a given. You don't have to go far for that. Right? It's not... When I say I'm a conscious being, we're not looking at all for a new experience, just the simple fact of it. And when you say I am a conscious being, the consciousness that you are, the conscious being that you are, is naturally identified with your physical body. It is naturally identified with your sense organs and with your mind. Okay? It's not naturally identified with the space. Right? So the natural identification of myself as a conscious being stops at this body. What doesn't stop at this body is the pervasion of consciousness for everything that I perceive and everything that I hear. So if you just think about it now, instead of accept the identification, this consciousness here, and you identify that consciousness with your body. Well, accept that identification. But accepting that, it is also true that there is nothing in your perception external to the physical body that is away from consciousness and being. Okay? So now look at this. As you sit here in the room and you say now, I am. For you, the amness that you're experiencing stops at the body. Right? Mm. So my being, when you say I am, my sense of being stops at the body. You can say, you know, my mind is, my sense organs are, my physical body is, this is all me, I am. Right? All these things are, it is, my body is, my mind is, my sense organs is, that all these things are, they all are. And then you say, and I am this. Okay? So that's where the identification is. But now, the amness that you're enjoying when you say I am, right? Does that amness change, go through a modification to become is? That's what I want you to recognize, is that your sense of being, the sense of amness that you have, does it modify to become is, like am is? And what you have to say there is, in fact, there is no duality. There's a duality in the language between am and is. Right? There's a duality. I am, you are, it is. There's a duality in the language, but there's not a duality in the experience. And that experience of isness is what is the very warp and woof of the creation. We take the isness to belong to this jiva. We take it, the isness, to belong to the jiva to become am, right? But what needs to be recognized is that the isness that has been given, usurped to the jiva, is actually the very being of the creation. And so how do we recognize that? How do we recognize that experientially? Right? And it's not a question. In the recognizing it experientially, It's a recognition of the reality of that experience that's already here. That's the thing. If you want to see, like, look, if you have a tapestry and you're looking at the tapestry, you can be engrossed in the painting of the tapestry, right? You can be engrossed in the seeing the sun and the clouds and the mountains and the lake and the people in the tapestry. You can be engrossed in that. Or you can look at that tapestry differently, and you can see what is the actual being of the tapestry, which is the thread going through it. And then you realize, gee, there is really nothing there but that thread. So now you're looking at it differently, right? You're looking at it differently. You're looking at it not at the names and forms, but you're looking at the very warp and woof, the very being that is actually there. Now, the thing is, in the tapestry, the individual within the tapestry has to look at the tapestry in that way. If I'm from here, as an individual outside looking at the tapestry, it's easy for me to see, that's just thread. That's just thread. But that's not our situation. We're an individual within the tapestry that has to look at the tapestry and realize that I, the individual in the tapestry, am of the same being, you know, as the mountain and the sun and the sky and the animals. I have to be able to look around, right, from within the tapestry as an individual in the tapestry and realize that everything about this body, mind, sense organs, this form, is part and parcel of the whole form, right? This body, mind, sense organs is part of the whole story, the whole picture, and the whole picture is made of one being. And that one being, which the whole picture is made out of, is not going to be an object in the picture, but is going to be the very substance, the very content, the very stuff, right? Because of which the picture can be, right? And that stuff you can't look at. You can't look at the stuff, right? The stuff which is the very being of everything in the tapestry. You can't look at it. You can only be it. So here, you can't look at existence. You are existence. When you say, I am, those words are part of the tapestry. They're part of the painting. When you say, I am, that's just a word, right? I am. You don't have to say that word. It's just imagine in the cloth tapestry, the little character in the tapestry, he says, I am, right? The I am is just labeling. What if he says, I am cloth? I am the cloth. He's a jnani. Okay. He says, I am the cloth. Those words are part of the painting, right? But they're referring to the stuff of the painting. So if the stuff of the tapestry. So if I say, I am consciousness, what are those words talking about? Say, I am existence. It's not the words, but the words are pointing to the stuff. The stuff which is not an object. And so now you say, I am an existent being. I am a conscious being. You say this. These are words. These words are pointing to something that cannot be objectified. They're not one of the objects in the tapestry. They're not one of the objects in the creation. They're not an object. They're not pointing to an object which I can objectify and look at. They're words that are pointing to the very substance which is the self of those words. It's the self of those words and of all words. Like, look at it, if I have two, what if I have sentences like this? I have one sentence like, I am pure consciousness. Those words happen to be directed at the nature of my being, the words. They're directed toward the nature of my being. I am pure, undivided consciousness. I am Brahman. My being is infinite. These are words. These words are pointing to the nature of myself. Now, what if I have some words that say something like, I am this physical body? The same conscious being is the self of those words also. Right? What if I say, the tree is beautiful? Look at the beautiful tree. The same conscious being is the self of those words also. It makes no difference what the words are. It makes no difference what the thought is, whether the thought is true or false. The conscious being is the warp and woof of whatever it happens to be. It doesn't matter. Whatever the vritti is, whatever the thought modification is, whatever the object is, whatever the experience is, the warp and woof is the conscious being. That never changes. It never goes anywhere. You know, it's like if you think of the tapestry, no matter what scene is painted on that tapestry, and what scene is woven into the tapestry is still thread, right? There can even be a sign on the tapestry that says, this tapestry is not thread. Doesn't make any difference. Thread is thread. What I'm saying is the conscious being that you are is the tapestry. It is the warp and woof, the invariable, the constant, the stuff of all of your experience, whether your mind knows that or not. If your mind says, I am the conscious, I am the body, that is because your mind, because of self-ignorance, is identifying this name and form with the stuff, right? It's like in the tapestry, the character in the tapestry says, I am the thread and you're not. Right? I am the thread here. I am the thread, but, you know, the mountain is inert. It's not thread. Only I am thread. I can say, only I am the conscious being. The chair is not. You know? And so the conscious being that I enjoy is different than the conscious being that you enjoy and different than the space, right? So that is our situation. That's our situation. So what we need to do is now, if the Upanishads have something here to reveal to us, which is quite a bit different than that, you know, what the Upanishad wants to do is to make you recognize your experience differently. It's not asking you to have another experience or to create an experience. If you have to create an experience, all you're doing is creating another state of mind. There's an infinite state of mind, an infinite number of states of mind, and that doesn't matter either. The state of mind is a part of part of the tapestry. It's the name and form again. So say you have a state of mind, and that state of mind, you've done pranayama, breathing exercises, japa, and all of this. The state of mind that you have is absolutely subtle, blissful, absolutely pure, beautiful, self-absorbed samadhi type of state of mind, right? Okay. And I am the substance of that. And now that state of mind goes crumbling down because something happened and brought you out of it, and some terrible thing is happening. And so from this beautiful, blissful state of mind, boom, 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 you're down now into an agitated mind, and I am the self of that. Whatever it is, I am the self of that. I am the being of that. These states of mind and these spirit experiences go on changing and changing and changing. I need to recognize right here and now the being that I am, the conscious being that I am, that is not an object, not objectifiable, but is the very warp and woof of the entirety of my experience. And so how do I do that? Well, first of all, I have to let myself relax and just see what is the reality here. The reality is that I, the conscious being, this me, that I take to be me right now, when you say I am the body, that one, that I, because the one that is the self of the body is as good as the self of the rug, so you might as well stay here. I am the one that is the self of this body. It is this I, the one that is the self of this mind. So if I say, I am the body and the mind, that's true. That is the one we're talking about. You are the body and the mind. You are the body and the mind. You are the prana. You are the you are all of the thoughts. You are all of the sense organs. You are all of the sense perceptions. You are all of that. There's nothing at all that's away from that. That's just like saying, you know, to the pot, you know, every part of you is the clay. Every single part, that's the truth. Every single part is the clay. Well, every single part of you is the self, everything. And there's nothing that can get away from it. You are the self. You are that. The problem is, though, is that where the disaster comes in the is that because the truth is, I am this body, right? But this body is not me. I am this body. I am this mind. But this body and mind are not me. Which means that when this body and mind drop and change, nothing happens to me. Because not only am I this body and this mind, I'm also this space, and I'm this rug, and I'm this chair. So that's where it gets a little difficult, right? Mm. Right? That's where it gets difficult, because this Dehatma Buddhi is so much. And this is why this Drik Drisha Viveka is so important, because look at what happens here. Am is. That's the problem. Am is. Knower known. Right? This duality, subject-object. It's a subject-object duality. But I have to discover that I'm both the subject and the object. I can't have this subject-object duality. Because actually, I'm the subject and the object. So how am I going to understand it? How am I going to see the reality of it experientially? Or how am I, let me say it like this, how am I going to understand my experience in this way? Because you're not going to have a new experience. You have to see your experience in this way, that I'm the subject and the object. The best way to do it is, one of the best ways to do it is to get there, to be able to say I'm the subject and the object, is first of all to recognize that your body and mind and sense organs are as much an object as everything else. That's the whole problem, is that here in this room, you have become the subject and everything else the object. This is the problem. This body, mind, sense organs are the subject and you're all the object. And of course, to you, I'm an object. But to me, I'm the subject, you're the object. And so what we have to do is recognize that, no, you all are the object. You're all objects to me. And the space is an object. All of these things are objects. These clothes are an object. And my body is also an object. My body also is as much an object to my sense perception as all of you are. Mm-hmm. So this body belongs in the room of objects. And so now the subject-object is a little bit different, right? It starts out with, I'm the subject, you're all the object. Remember, where we have to get to is, I am the subject and the object. That's where we have to go. I'm the warp and woof of this whole thing. And you have to see that. Well, so, let's see it then. Is your body known to you through your sense perception or not? Just start getting rid of the sense organs. And your body goes. Your body is an object of sense perception. Get rid of your sense of touch. That should change things. It will. You know? This body belongs to it's an object of sense perception. Now what about your sense organs? Your sense organs, when I look at them, they're all objects to me. I see your ears, I see your eyes, I see your lips, I see your nose. You see your skin, you know? I'm aware of them. And you know, I see my eyes and my ears and my sense of touch also with my mind. I objectify them because I know if they work. I know if my ears work. I know how my eyes are doing. I know if my sense of touch works. I know if my sense of taste works. So they're also known. They're also known. So now the world of objects has now just gained the bodies and sense organs of all of us. And what about the mind? The mind also is known. All of my thoughts, all of my moods, all of my emotions, they're also known. But they're the sakshi. They're objects of awareness. We're aware of them changing. If that's so, then now I've stripped. Look at what's happening. Because I have to become there can't be subject-object. I have to be subject and object. But now, everything that so far, so many things that I had thought were the subject are now only the object. They're all belonging to the creation. It's true also with the I thought, I am. I am seeing you. Actually, I'm seeing that thought. The thought that says, I am seeing you, the thought that says, I am the subject and you are the object, that thought is known. It also belongs to the world of the object. And so now look what happens. Just if you recognize this, this is something for you actually to recognize the reality of it in your experience. Like if I say, are you aware of your body through your sense perception, sense organs? That's not hypothetical. This isn't theory. This is something for you to experience the reality of it, right? Are you aware of the thoughts in your mind? This isn't a theory. It's a yes or no. It's your experience. Every time you make that differentiation, what is happening is what has given you the limiting factors that make you a jiva are being removed. If you remove the limiting factors from you, the jiva, as a jiva, the body, the mind, the sense organs, the thoughts, the moods, the emotion, even the I thought. If I remove all of those things from me, because I am the subject, these things are the object, then what is the limiting factor that's left from this self that cannot be objectified? I've just eliminated everything that can be objectified. What is the limiting factor left for the subject? The subject, and what is the subject? It's just me. Just me, that's all. Because we're not looking for any new experience, we're just recognizing in this experience what can be objectified. So what is left? Only me. And who am I? I'm not the body, I'm not the mind, I'm not the sense organs, I'm not the I thought, I'm not the moods, I'm not the emotions. All of those things belong to the picture. They're all part of the painting. So who am I? What size am I? Am I 5'8"? Am I a woman? Am I smart or stupid? Or am I young or old? All of these things belong to the painting, right? They're not this. They don't belong to me. They don't belong to the subject. And then we say, well, this subject, where is it located? Where am I located? Am I sitting on the chair? Is consciousness sitting on the chair? Is the conscious being sitting on the chair? Is the conscious being that I am sitting in this room? The body is sitting on the chair in this room. Is consciousness sitting in the chair in the room? The conscious being that I am, is it separate from you? Are there two of us? I'm not your body. That's obvious. I'm not your sense organs. That's separate. I'm not your mind. That's separate. I'm not your thoughts. I'm not your I thought, that's separate. One thought is different from the other. What about me, the conscious being? Are there two? What would divide us? Space. Space is objectified. Right? Bodies. Bodies are objectified. Minds. Minds are objectified. Sense organs. Sense organs are objectified. I thought. I thought is objectified. There's one thing here that is not objectified, and that is me, the conscious being, the me, the self. Now, if all of these things, the body, mind, sense organs, all of these things are actually objectified, there is now what we have is one subject and one object. The object is made of many things, right? But there's one subject. That is the self, one subject, that is the self of many objects. Let me put this like this. Right now, I say, I am the self of this body. I am the conscious being of this body. Right? I'm the conscious being of this body. If I give this body over to the collective, then I am the conscious being of this room. You see what I mean? In other words, if this body, mind, sense organs does not contain me, the conscious being, and I am the conscious being of this body, right? Then, and you say, but I am the conscious being of this body. In fact, I am the conscious being of all bodies. And look at your experience. Put the body, mind, sense organs into the room because they're objects. And now, recognizing that the body, mind, sense organs are in the room as objects and the I thought, right? Is there anything in the room that is away from consciousness? Say no, there isn't. Is there anything in the room that is away from existence? No. It is. Now look, when we say it is, this is, we say this is, it is. Think of it like this. This pot is clay. The pot is clay. The clay pot. This is the clay of the pot, right? This is. We say it is, this is. You're right, it is. It is, but is not an object. There is no is apart from am. I call it is. Let's say it like this. It is, I is. It is, I is. That's what it is. Or we have to say, I am, it am, it am, it am, it am, it am, it am. There's no am to is. There's no migration from am to is. What we find is that the amness, in fact, which is me, right? When I give the body, mind, sense organs, everything over to the creation as objects of awareness, then I am this. Rather than just I am the body, I am this. Do you see what I mean? If you can say with so much conviction, I am the body, and then you realize that the body, mind, sense organs, all of it, belong to the creation, then why don't you just say, I am this? And that's the truth of your experience anyway. It is the truth of your experience. Try to find anything that is away from I am, the being that this I am, the words point to. Right? And so that's why here in this verse he says, yes, men, the one in whom all the heavens, means the entire creation, all the heavens, the earth, and everything in between. The one who is the warp and woof of all of that, and the work of and work of the mind, the sense organs, the prana, the individuality, the one who is the warp and woof of the whole thing, know that one who is Ekam, that who is one alone, know that that one is yourself, Atman. Forget about everything else. Nothing else leads to liberation. This alone leads to liberation. This alone is liberation. This alone is the means for moksha, for amritasya. Because everything else lives in the world of name and form, in cause and effect, in doing. The only thing that is liberated is yourself. Otherwise, you are within, you are existing within nama rupa, existing within name and form, right? And then subject to the vagaries of time and space, and subject to the vagaries of change. And so if you're subject to the vagaries of change, that means that anything that you do will have a result, and it can have a positive result, but those positive results are bound by time. And so everything is samsara. Samsara means everything is continually moving without end. Samyak saraha. Sraya means that which moves. That's what, you know, that's what goes. Samyak means it does it so well. It never stops. It never stops moving. And so there is no liberation in that which by its nature transforms and changes. Where's the liberation in that? It depends on what you mean by liberation. Liberation here is amritasya, that which is free from death, free from change, that which is the whole. Right? So that from the vision of that Vedanta, it's really, you know, may you know yourself to be the warp and woof of all of this, to be the Ekam, one without a second. That your being, that the Atma that you are, is not this subject, unless you say, I am the subject and the object. It's fine and very revealing to recognize that I, the one who is this body, is Brahman. That this, that I, when I say, I am this body, me, different from you, because this body is different from you. You say, I, this one here, is Brahman. And when you understand that, then you have to be able to say, yes, this one here, this I that I am, this is Brahman. And what that means is that the I that I am, that is this body, is the self of the lamp, and is the self of the table, and is the self of you, and is the self of the space. To the degree that I can say, I am this body, once I give this body and mind and sense organs as objects to the world, then the I that is this body is the I that is the world. That I is non-objectifiable. Okay. So that's enough for now. Let's take a minute. Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
You know, what is interesting is that what you just unfolded, in a certain way, it's like Ramana was like after the same thing. It kind of feels that way anyway to me. You just never really broke it down that way. You know what I mean?
He would always take you back to the Atma. But he usually wouldn't focus on the fact that the Atma is Ishvara. But he always would take you to who's asking the question. Who's the one that's really there?
So is that enough? I mean,
well, my question actually was that I wanted to add to this is, so when you say that, is I'm just kind of wondering how much is your experience in this moment where you know this on a deeper level because you've been kind of contemplating on this for a long time. How is your experience with the world around you and your connection to it different from my experience sitting here, you know, just kind of starting to get a grip on this, you know? You know what I mean? It's like, how does this actually experientially differ? And does it matter, actually? Because, for example, in Taoism, if you kind of understand, for example, how a certain energy flows, it means actually nothing. But unless you feel that energy in your body, you know, so, and then it becomes like a living reality or something, you know. So I'm kind of trying to see how does it work in Vedanta. It's like, how does this transformation actually that comes from the embodiment of that transmigrate into you actually into I don't know, not form, but because it's kind of formless. But you know what I mean?
Well, I think that the experience of the mind is so different between a jnani and an ajnani, and it's because, not because the self is different, but because the mind's way of relating to itself and to the creation are so different, you know. And so the mind is always put into a situation of having to seek for some stability, having to seek for something to make it happy so that it can relax. So it's, the mind itself is totally a victim of the situation and the environment. It has no home to rest because that knowledge, that differentiation hasn't been there. But for a mind that has recognized, then no matter where it goes, the substance of your being is there, stable, always. That never changes. It never changes anyway, right? But but for a mind, the mind either has recognized that reality or it hasn't. And if it hasn't recognized it, then it usurps that being to only itself. It, you know, and so then the self takes on all the qualities from the standpoint of the mind that the mind has. So if the mind is unhappy, the self is unhappy.
Mm-hmm.
And then it gets into a lot of tangles. And the fact is that the self is always the same. But if a mind knows that and is recognized, then that mind is relaxed. And it just has a different, whole different way of being in the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and in either case, the self is there as the warp and woof. One mind recognizes it and so relaxes into that, and another mind doesn't. And so it's creating pain for itself. I mean, pain
yeah.
exists, right? I mean,
yeah. Even conceptually, this makes total sense to me. I'm just kind of waiting for breakthrough where I can actually feel this moment to moment. It becomes my living reality, you know. That's just, must be so awesome. I mean, like what you were saying, it's such a freedom, there must be a freedom in that. That is a deep profoundness. the peace that comes to that when you actually feel that. When you, because you don't remember, you were saying, right? You're, at some point you were saying you don't remember these things. It's not like you're getting something and then you just hold that in your memory. It's more like there's a certain kind of recognition that then becomes part of how you relate.
Well, let's wonder why that, say in your own case, why is not that recognition not taking place? Like for instance, it is a fact, just very simply, that if I sit and watch my mind,
mm-hmm.
that I'm aware of the mind.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fact. It's an experiential fact. That's a recognition.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, it's also a fact that if I can watch one thought go, next go, and I continue to be present.
Mm-hmm.
That is a fact. It's, you're recognizing that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's a definite recognition. It's not intellectual.
Mm-hmm.
That's embodied.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so now, all along the way, step by step, it's a recognition. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
So then it's just that, what are the areas of recognition
uh-huh.
that need to take place
uh-huh.
that are missing?
Right. So it's like a sequence, these little breaks of some sort.
Like, well,
they're like breaks into...
It is kind of like that.
Evolutionarily, I mean, there's certain breaks until these gaps become smaller, and there's just moment-to-moment recognition of what it really is.
Well, there comes a time that there never is any break, because the mind, whatever little snags were there in the mind that we call doubts or little areas of not
mm-hmm.
understanding,
mm-hmm.
you know, that seem like a little break, those are gone.
Mm-hmm.
And so then there's nothing that the mind can do any longer to usurp to itself your being. It's clear.
Mm-hmm.
It recognizes yourself for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
See what I mean? Yourself is always there shining. But the mind can either say, I am that self. In other words, and the thing is, as I was trying to say today, the self is the mind, but the mind isn't the self. I mean, the self is the thought, but the thought isn't the self. So that's why, you know, the thought can come and go, and while it's there, it is you. But when it goes, you know, then the next thing is you. Then when it goes, the next thing is you. The you doesn't come and go. And so that's what has to be differentiated, and that's recognition. Okay, then the next thing is, and this is, I think, where we talk about knowledge actually bearing fruit. It's not just enough to recognize the constancy of my own being. I need to recognize it as the source of, as fullness in and of itself, and the source of fullness for the mind. And as I start to understand that, the mind stops going out looking for its happiness in the world, you know, and that's what causes all the pain, you know. That's why we feel, well, this knowledge is good and everything, but I'm still suffering. You know, I'm suffering, but I'm suffering because, you know, I need the world to be different in order for me to be happy. That's why I suffer. I need you to be different for me to be happy. This to be different for me to be happy. I need things to be different, you know. It's always that way, and that's the samsara.
See, I feel like, and I haven't really explored that, but I kind of sense it a little bit. I sense there's a certain, it's like coming to a door, right? And then you just, it kind of feels like sitting here, like in satsang, so to speak, right?
Yeah.
And it's like coming to a door, opening the door, and discovering another component of what wasn't seen before, right?
Yeah.
But then, in that moment, comes also I think there's an instinctual kind of thing that kicks in. I'm just starting to get more in touch with that. It's like there's a part that wonders, well, how am I going to still function? You know, because what you just described is a really nice description, but there's a certain kind of, well, what's going to motivate me? Because I already feel that with the world, you know, what motivate, it's like for sannyasi, that's like a perfect mindset, you know, or a perfect state of being. I just feel like, to me, the challenge is to go out there and still do things in the world, you know, and to actually be part of this whole samsara, in a way.
Yeah,
you know, with that kind of consciousness, seems there's a certain kind of paradoxical something that kind of really
well,
exists
Well, I think
in that.
What cuts through that
uh-huh.
is that what causes you to take this body is the power of the karma.
Yeah.
that karma will keep you going. It's just things aren't complicated
mm-hmm.
because your karma is fine. This is you took this birth and this life belongs to you. It will unfold in the way that it unfolds, and so that becomes kind of a very kind of interesting, and you can relax into it and trust
mm-hmm.
that you will get what is yours. Really, and I think that's for me that was a beautiful realization actually, is that
mm-hmm.
I don't have to worry. I'll get what is coming to me. This is my life,
mm-hmm.
and the prarabdha takes care of itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so the things that you end up, once as your knowledge, once you recognize the source of any ananda really is your own being, the relaxation of your mind, then even the desires and the things that you go toward aren't things, well, the Joneses over here have that and they seem to be happy, so I'll have that.
Mm-hmm.
Rather, it's what is just naturally unfolding in your life. That's what you're doing, that's who you are, and that's the life that you're living. And so any motivation or desire is appropriate because it's your karma unwinding.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you can be engaged in that.
Mm-hmm.
How does your mind recognize more and more that yourself is the source of the ananda? I mean, you said that.
Well, yeah, because you understand the logic of it, you know,
mm-hmm.
because there's so many unfoldments that we do
yeah.
to make you see the fact of it.
Mm.
Like, for instance, the whole unfoldment, to understand how the desire template works. You know,
mm-hmm.
I want this
mm-hmm.
so I can be happy. Then
mm-hmm.
I go after it.
Mm-hmm.
And that moment when I get it, my mind relaxes.
Mm-hmm.
At that moment, I experience the ananda. So there's a lot of unfoldments to make me recognize that, you know, it has that happiness has nothing to do with the object at all.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
It really has to do with the relaxation of the mind.
Right.
And
but even that, to me anyway, doesn't quite take it all the way to the you know,
the swarupananda.
Yeah,
the swarupananda is the recognition, and it's nice initially for you to have a little bit of maybe in meditation or when your mind's a little relaxed. Later, you don't need
mm-hmm.
that at all. Your own being, that's what has to do with recognizing that which is most dear to you is your own being.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the ananda.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the ananda of a bliss that comes and goes. It's just recognizing the beloved,
mm-hmm.
that your own presence is the most dear. And then even in meditation, to meditate on that and to see the truth of it.
Mm-hmm.
Not trying to have an experience,
mm-hmm.
but to just see the fact of it, that there is nothing more dear to you than yourself, you know, and to see what is that is so dear, then you'll understand, oh, this is why they say ananda.
Mm-hmm.
Right? This is, you should ask yourself, why do they say this me is ananda, satchitananda? What is ananda about it? You can ask yourself, is there anything more dear to me than this? And you have to say, no, there's nothing. And then, so when you realize that, okay, then when you realize that, then you realize that never goes. It's never not here, ever. Ever. It doesn't matter what you're thinking, what you're feeling, you are there, and that is the beloved, and you, and that is Brahman. That is the Brahman. You know, that will never not be there, and that's the moksha. You recognize that which is most dear will never not be, has never not been, and will never not be. And then when you look out into the world, you recognize, you know, when you just relax and let this body and mind and sense organs be part of the perceptual world, right? And then you recognize yourself, your own presence, you know, which is its own self shining. Then you see you're not contained. You're not contained in the body. You know, you are. And you are the very being that everything else is. There's a lot more. I mean, we have to do a lot more work, circle around, and then look at the nature of this that we think is actually something here. And show that the warp and woof of this is only consciousness. That there is no object here that you can find other than being, which is non-objectifiable. We have to make your mind see that. So there's different logics and teaching methodologies, taking this all apart.
Well, when we say it is, you know, mm-hmm. we say the object is an object. This may seem like a silly question in a way, but we know it is through our sense organs, right? The object.
Well, that's how it starts.
Yeah.
But in fact, mm-hmm. when you say the object is, you know the name and form through your sense organs.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know the being. The
mm-hmm.
being is something which you are, in fact.
Yeah.
That's not an object. And then you say, this object is. And then I ask you, what object are you talking about?
Uh-huh.
And then we start analyzing this to see if we can find an object here. And we can't. We'll never find an object in the creation. We find conglomerates.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, there is no such thing as an object, because you get to the smallest object imaginable, and you still need to get to the substance of it, right? Get to the
mm-hmm.
smallest form imaginable, and you still mm-hmm. to get to the substance of it, right? You have to take off the form.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You can't define one form by smaller forms. So you've got to take off the form to get to the substance, and if you take off the form to get to the substance, there's no form there, so you can't see it. And so what you discover is, no matter what the form, what is always left is being, non-objectifiable being.
Mm-hmm.
You have to get to what is the stuff of the form. The stuff of the form will never be the form itself. The content of the form, the substance. You can never define substance or what is in terms of the form. You could say the substance could take a form, but the substance is not defined by the form, ever. And so what is the substance? It's not going to be a form. In your case, here you are as a jiva. The substance can't be defined by a form. Oh, then what is it? What is it going to be? Well, it's going to be me, because I am the one here. But this me can't be a form. And how could I be a form anyway? Because if I were a form, who's illumining the form? Okay. The substance actually is conscious being. So. The problem is, you can take all of this, just a bunch of words being thrown at you,
no.
right? But the words have to land on the reality of yourself, because they're pointing to something that's actually
mm-hmm.
actually here.
Mm-hmm.
So the words have to be, they have to work as a pramana.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have to be hitting the object that they're aimed at. For you to see, because your eyes can't see. Your eyes can't see this. Your ears can't hear it. It's not a sound.
Mm-hmm.
What we're talking about. It's not a sound. It's not a form. It's not something you can touch. Right. And so the words of the Upanishad have to act as a pramana to make the mind recognize
mm-hmm.
what it can't see or hear, what it can't objectify.
And when this pramana is in action, it doesn't take a whole lot of thinking or logic in your own mind to see what's being said, right? It just shows.
If your mind is hooked on to the teacher's mind,
mm-hmm.
And then it's just going along, seeing what's being pointed out.
Yeah.
And then your mind will go along to for a certain point, and then it'll go, what, wait? You know, and then that's a doubt. That's where you have to say, stop. I didn't follow there. I didn't see that. That's a doubt. Then you have to deal with that particular doubt. Then the vision will be unfolding, you know, and your mind will go, yeah.
So only when it gets off track, then
yeah.
You have the idea.
Mm-hmm. Because your mind is just seeing.
Mm.
The teacher's mind is seeing, your mind is seeing. There's no teacher, student, there's just seeing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then something, if the unfoldment isn't going exactly in pace with your mind, then your mind will get a doubt, get thrown off track. Then that needs to be cleared up, and then that's how it goes.
Mm-hmm.
And it just keeps going that way, you know, until the mind kind of moves through like the wind through everything. There's no lack of clarity. And so you just keep going through all from all every different angle possible, so that you see it clearly.
Now that was good what you said today, because I'm not sure if I'd ever heard you say that before. Maybe I have. I just didn't click in that. You know, the being that is the being of the body. You know, if you make the body an object, then your own being is the being of all objects.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but then still, I think for Yanni, there's this recognition. I would assume my being is the being of all objects.
Mm-hmm.
So that's like a point of what?
Yeah.
How's
she
that?
Said it before.
Huh?
She said it before.
No, when you say, I'll tell you what gets into the, what gets, will trip you up there, is that you don't see being.
Mm-hmm.
You are being,
yeah.
And nothing's away from that. Once that's recognized, then the stability of your being and nothing being away from it, that is seen. Right? Because your being isn't located. You're not just located only belonging to this body. And so everything is in you, but you're not trying to see you along with everything else. I think maybe that's where you get screwed up a little bit.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I can see like that my being lights up my knowledge, you know, lights up my mind. And that's the only way I know anything, is because through the mind, through vrittis. So the being lights up the vrittis.
But then if you recognize just the being itself, which is not a knower, consciousness is not a knower, it's just you.
Mm-hmm.
You're not a knower. The mind is a knower with the sense organs. There's knowership there. Knower known belongs to the creation, right? To the little man in the painting.
Mm-hmm.
There's the knower known.
Mm-hmm.
Being is not involved in knower knowns. It's just your own presence.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, if you just focused on just your own presence and then let your sense organs be aware of the room, you know, you can't separate your presence from the room. Do you see what I mean? Consciousness is not located.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's nothing, there's no, it's not sitting on the chair, you
mm-hmm.
know,
mm-hmm.
like that. And so then where is it?
Mm-hmm.
It has nothing to do with location. And so you recognize that all of this is in yourself.
Mm-hmm.
All those words are meaningless unless you just practice it and see.
Mm-hmm.
You said this mantra is a Mahavakya. This one particular mantra basically has the whole...
It does.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it does, because it starts out saying, the one in whom the heavens and the earth and the intervening space is, and the mind and the pranas, together with the pranas, the vital force, all of those things, the one in whom all of these things are woven, otam means woven, right? Then it says, Janata, may you know that one, Atman, to be yourself. Right? Then, Anyaha Vachaha, Vimuchita. Let go of everything else, all the other words. First part of it. Yeah. Then it says, you know, it is this is the setu, this is the bridge for immortality, amritasya.
For moksha.
For moksha, yeah. It's an amazing verse. Mm-hmm. It's really good.
So knowing God.
May you know that one, Brahman, in whom this whole creation is woven. May you know that one to be the Atma.
And which is
yourself.
Yourself, but to get to that is through the teaching.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And now the next verse, he's going to continue on and then take it back to Om, the meditation on Om.
Oh, and bring it back down.
didn't the Om verses came before, right?
Yeah, now there's this verse, then another verse takes it back to Om, the meditation on Om. There were two Om verses, and this one, and now there'll be another one.
I'm going to review the other ones.
Yeah, read Swamiji's Bhasha on these things. His commentary in the... Yeah, it's good. Yeah, very good.
Wow, we had quite a class.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was great.
Are we done?
So how many Mahavakyas are there in...
Oh, there's lots.
I mean, in just this Upanishad.
I don't know. I have to count them. Go through.
But...
With the Mahavakyas, any time... Uh-huh. They bring the identity between Atma and Brahman together in one verse as a Mahavakya.
Mm-hmm.
Like in this verse, it's an obvious Mahavakya.
Uh-huh.
Is that what Swamiji means by the equation?
Yeah.
Because
mm-hmm.
it appears the equation.
The equation.
Oh.
It appears that there's a difference, but there's another.
Like if I say, here's the equation.
Mm-hmm.
You are Ishwara. The jiva is Ishwara.
Yeah.
The jiva can't be Ishwara. If we take the jiva as the limited individual and Ishwara as a whole infinite creation, how can you be Ishwara? So that's the equation. You have to get to what is the underlying truth of both for there to be an equation there. Or, you know, if I say, you are Brahman, you, the self that you are, is infinite. You know, how can you be Brahman? So you have to, what has to happen is all of the things that you are not have to be shed in order to recognize the truth, you know, if it's a truthful statement. Yeah. Okay.
Akhandata, mm-hmm.